Polar explorers were always talking about filling in the blank spaces on the map, but what did that mean exactly? Today, some of the best polar maps and some of the most important discoveries are not coming out of McMurdo Station, but a small brick building in Minnesota. It's time to eat the dogs. I'm Michael Robinson. Today, Cole Kelleher talks about his work for the Polar Geospatial Center at the University of Minnesota, an agency that uses satellite data to support polar scientists in the field. In addition to making maps, Kelleher works with scientists in Antarctica and this is really the coolest thing, has teamed up with Google to provide all of its street views for McMurdo Station in Antarctica. Cole Kelleher, thanks so much for talking to me today.
Thanks, Michael. Glad to be here.
So I think when a lot of people think about polar science, I think they probably imagine scientists in parkas taking ice core samples, you know. But that's not really the all of it, is it? I was wondering if you could talk about the Polar Geospatial Center and what it does.
Yeah, so there still is a lot of parka and ice core research that is done. However, the organization that I'm a part of, the Polar Geospatial Center, provides mapping and logistical support to these science groups and logistical initiatives to make their field seasons more efficient. So they don't have to use old maps. We have updated satellite imagery and a lot of geospatial data that we've recorded to make their science more efficient. And a lot of times the satellite imagery gives people enough sense of what's going on that they don't need to necessarily go to specific research sites. They can monitor sites remotely using this high resolution imagery that we can provide.
The center is only about 10 years old. Was it formed because of a set of problems with polar research that you guys are trying to solve?
I think so. There's a number of problems when you deal with the Arctic and Antarctic. So we were originally founded to support the Antarctic because the United States has a very large science initiative there with McMurdo Station, South Pole Station, and Palmer Station. Largely, the data that's available is very sparse in the polar regions because companies don't really care about these regions because there isn't a lot of commercial interest, especially in Antarctica with the Antarctic Treaty. But the program came to us and had a need for mapping, and just from a purely safety standpoint, the maps prior to us were done by the USGS in the 50s and 60s. Beautiful maps, you know, shaded by hand. They are absolutely works of art, but they're dated. And they don't provide enough detail for the new teams and the amount of science that is going on. So we came along and were tasked to provide updated maps, record geospatial data, aggregate that data. So when we refer to, say, a certain place name, we all know what that place is. We all have the same maps and are cohesively using the geographic information on a program-wide basis versus, you know, researcher X gets this data from this website and researcher Y gets data from another website. They now all come to us and can all be working on the same page.
So you were mentioning logistics and how the earlier maps are just not really sufficient for logistics. Is that because the continent is changing? I mean, is it because of ice conditions and that sort of thing? And what are the logistic qualities that you're, or the logistic information you're providing?
Sure. I would say the maps were done to the best of their ability, but the accuracy is very variable in those old maps. And so now that we have, you know, regular flights that go to the South Pole every austral summer and on the order of hundreds to occasionally thousands of people going out into the field, there's a huge safety risk in that. And so there's a large need for increased accuracy of the geospatial data. And we've definitely worked very hard to provide the most accurate data that we can for these initiatives, because there is some change in the ice conditions, but largely in the old maps, you couldn't see the actual ice conditions. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were, I don't want to say embellished, but they were hand-drawn, and there's inherent error in hand-drawing things.
So where does the data come from for these maps?
It comes from a variety of sources. Our primary resource for our maps and high-accuracy data is high-resolution commercial satellite imagery from Digital Globe, which is licensed to us for a federal purpose, which we fall under that federal purpose as part of an NSF awarded group and the U.S. Antarctic program.
And you said these are commercial satellites. So these satellites are producing geographical data for Google or for other companies?
Yes, Google does purchase this data and put it into Google Earth and Google Maps. We've actually had a pretty strong partnership with Google in the past where we've suggested which images to put into Google Maps, mm-hmm. because they don't necessarily know what people want to see. And we know where the science is happening and what people want to see in the polar regions. So if we can provide that to Google, they can put that into Google Earth, and our science users can go in and use Google Earth and see their research sites in a much higher resolution.
So you're saying that you're actually going, when you said that Google doesn't have as much knowledge as you guys about what people want to see, are you talking about the general public or scientists who would go to Google Earth looking at Antarctica and checking out the images there?
I would say it's mostly the latter, but mm-hmm. in general, when you zoom into Antarctica, do you know what you're looking for? You know, it's a big place. Yeah. I mean, it's 1.5 times the size of the lower 48. So pinpointing any activity that is interesting, especially from a science standpoint, you know, say there's a ice core or drill camp. I mean, that's also good outreach for them that you can go into Google Earth and look at the camp at a high resolution. As far as the general public goes, I think there's a lot of data on what the general public is interested in between 60 degrees north and 60 degrees south. But outside of that, it's pretty sparse.
You know, it's kind of interesting because you give me the impression that it's not scientists going to Antarctica and kind of dictating to you guys, well, we need X, Y, and Z for our work here. It sounds a little bit like you guys are curating some of this information, like, oh, this is cool and this will probably be of interest and we know it's there because of the satellite data, so we're going to make it available and then hopefully people will use it. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I would say there's definitely actually a lot of science where we work with the scientists and figure out what they want to see, but there is also a very large component to our work that is centered on preemptively collecting and archiving data that we think will be useful in the future. Specifically, I would say in the Arctic, a good example of that is any coastal area and populated place in the Arctic. I mean, we are actively trying to collect data over the populated places in the Arctic because those are the communities, as the climate continues to change, that will be on the front lines and will change first. Likely. So we're actively trying to create an archive of data. So when change does occur, we have the before. Same thing with outlet glaciers in Greenland and Alaska and the Antarctic as well. It's definitely a balancing act between what current science is interested in and what we think future science will be interested in.
One of the other things that you mentioned that you study actively is elevation, mm-hmm. and you create elevation models. Why is elevation such an important component or variable in polar research?
Yeah, so I think just to back up on elevation, in the polar regions, historically, there's really, really bad elevation data because of these areas are so remote. So why it is so important is a lot of science that depends on topography and how the landscape is shaped doesn't have a good digital model to work off of in these areas. So, for example, the Arctic DEM that we've been working on is a 2 meter resolution elevation model for the entire Arctic above 60 degrees north.
DEM meaning a digital elevation model.
Yeah, yes. That's a huge improvement as far as the resolution. There are areas in the Arctic that have been mapped at greater resolutions using airborne LIDAR and other sensors, but this is a Arctic-wide. It's a very, very huge area, and we're doing something similar in the Antarctic. And this information is really important because, like I said, the previous elevation models are very poor at best, and this gives you so much more information about the topography that isn't necessarily visible in the satellite imagery. So when we talk to researchers in Antarctica, and they come into our office and are looking to hike to a specific field site, we look at the imagery, but sometimes you can't tell how steep a slope is, or is this terrain really what it looks like? Are these crevasses or are they sastrugi? And this gives us a little bit more information about what the topography is actually like and what they'll be seeing in the field.
And I can imagine that elevation data would be really important for people studying climate change if you're concerned about melting ice.
Absolutely.
Is that the primary scientific motive for collecting this data, or are there other kinds of projects?
That's definitely an important one, but there's a variety of different projects. I see this data as such an improvement on previous data that it's kind of the new baseline. Mm-hmm. It is a very contiguous data set with a few exceptions, but there is other initiatives that can benefit from this. For example, in Greenland, we had a Greenland student in our office who is working on using this data to delineate watersheds around Greenlandic villages. So they could protect those watersheds and not pollute them because that's their water source, which is a very interesting thing and hasn't been able to have been done before. So it's really interesting to see that type of project come out of this data when it was pretty much unexpected from our end as far as, oh, this is an application that we didn't even think of. And I suspect that there'll be many, many more as time goes on.
Yeah. You know, I think we are all growing more familiar with GIS, you know, geographic information systems, because it's percolated into our lives in so many ways, like the use of Google Maps, and especially. What are the differences you see in moving from these old printed maps to newer GIS type maps?
The major difference, I would say, is there's quite a few. A major difference is just the ability to update information. Groups like Planet are looking to image the entire Earth every day at 4 meter resolution. That gives you so much more information about the Earth and its current status. An additional difference is the ability to interact with this data and maps. You know, say change the way a certain data set is presented to you, pull relationships out of these maps that, you know, in a static map it doesn't facilitate, you know, you comparing and contrasting different types of data and interacting with that in a way that you can actually make inferences from. So that to me is one of the biggest differences.
Yeah.
From a digital standpoint, there's much more exploration, if you will, into the amount of data that we have. So because we're collecting so much data and putting it online and making it available on crowdsourcing websites like TomNod or Zooniverse, our innate desire to explore, to analyze these data sets and have people go in and pull information out that, you know, others might not see. It's just a much higher level of human interaction with these digital maps and digital data versus, you know, static maps that it's kind of a one-way transaction where we just use it to navigate. Now we're actually interacting with maps, which is a very, very exciting thing.
What are the, do you know what the specific projects are that have been crowdsourced through these sites?
Yeah. I mean, Tomnod, if you're not familiar, is Digital Globe's crowdsourcing platform. And so when Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 went down, they were actively collecting data over the ocean, and you could go in and pan through imagery and look for debris, and mark if you thought you saw something, as well as other, you know, there's scientific applications. So we work with a seal researcher and penguin researcher who is trying to get a census on the amount of seals in Antarctica and around the Antarctic continent. And the only way to see them is when they're out of the water laying on the sea ice. And so she has been working with Tomnod to put imagery of sea ice around Antarctica into their system. And you can go in and mark where seals are. And that is very beneficial because you could try and do a classification, but really in Antarctica, when something's dark, it's either rock or it's a seal. so things can get confused, but the human eye and your ability to pick out relationships, you can actually go in and it's easy to see what a seal is. And they provide examples as well. But as far as Zooniverse goes, my favorite one is the Galaxy Zoo, where you can go in and classify galaxies. And you very well could be the first person classifying a specific galaxy. You know, I think that type of stuff is very exciting.
You know, it strikes me as interesting that, you know, probably in the 50s and 60s, you had humans designing research projects. And for, you know, their kind of computational brute power, they would load these ideas into early computers, I guess ENIAC or the later ones. And we seem to be going through this period where I don't know if it's exactly the reverse or not, but you know, you have essentially these data sets that are being created by computers, and then you're harnessing the massive brute power of human observers to check it out and figure out what's real and what's not real. What's a rock? What's a seal? I know they're doing it with exoplanet research as well. They've actually discovered planets in various solar systems based upon crowdsourcing. It's really kind of incredible. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, you know, I think maps have become so ubiquitous for people nowadays, either, you know, from the temperature maps and the climate maps we see in the newspaper to Google Maps that we use all the time. And I think people lose track. I lose track of the fact that they aren't, in fact, natural objects. You know, humans make them, we construct them. And I can imagine that that's only more profoundly true for GIS maps. You must have to make so many decisions about how you represent Antarctica to people.
Absolutely.
What do you take out? What do you take in? I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah. So in Antarctica, it's a little easier because we don't have vegetation to deal with. Our only seasons are night and day, or winter and summer. And so in large part, the surface is what it is. There's no disputing that. And so in a way, we're lucky in that respect because we don't have to make as many of those decisions on what to keep in, what to keep out. But as with any map design, you have to think about how you're going to represent your data, whether you're going to use a certain color ramp to represent something. You know, we go through this all the time where, you know, red is associated with bad, green is associated with good. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of design consideration that goes into any map. Most of the maps we make these days have satellite imagery as the base map. So it's in the background. So we don't have to make those types of decisions of, am I going to show ice fields and geology? We just use an image to make it look a little bit more realistic.
Yeah. You I remember seeing the talk that you and Claire Porter, a remote sensing scientist who works for the Polar Geospatial Center, gave at the Library of Congress. I guess this was 4 or 5 mm-hmm. years ago. And you guys were talking about some things that you saw in Antarctica that no one has seen before, even people on the ground. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah. So the things that we're able to see are obviously largely a part of commercial satellite imagery, but we're able to see glaciers that are calving or changing without having a human there and able to monitor those changes. There is a limit to our ability to perceive things in the field, right? We only have an awareness that goes so far. And so using satellite imagery, it's really interesting that we can kind of have eyes on things all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically in, let's say, Greenland, there's a lot of changes that are happening on the Greenland ice sheet. And we've been able to actively see and monitor subglacial lakes that are collapsing and then filling back up with water, pushing the ice sheet back up, which is a very interesting phenomenon that no one's recorded in the field.
I remember you saying that you have these sometimes quite massive lakes that form on the surface of glaciers and then suddenly disappear. Yep. Is that correct? And so where's all the water going?
It's going down underneath the ice sheet. So what happens is a hole forms, it's called a moulin, and the water drains and it goes under the ice sheet. And there's a lot of science going on that is trying to understand what that does to the ice sheet. Does it provide lubrication to speed up the glacial pace or flow? Does it stay down there? Is it feeding out into the ocean and contributing to sea level rise? So there's a lot of questions on what actually happens to that water, and a lot of research that's being done to try and answer those questions, which is really interesting and exciting, because understanding the glacial dynamics is very important for us to understand how these ice landscapes are changing and will contribute to changes around the world that we see in the future.
Yeah. You know, one of the questions that preoccupies a lot of people interested in exploration, you know, from the Explorers Club all the way through NASA, is what does exploration actually mean? Is, you know, does it mean that you stick a human in a suit and you go somewhere? you know, boots on the ground, flag planting. That's certainly what we've meant classically by exploration. But just all of the examples you've just given me, from, you know, people hanging out in their living room, crowdsourcing information about the number of seals in Antarctica that literally no one else has seen, or your own work seeing glacial lakes disappear remotely from your lab in Minnesota, although I guess you're in Boulder now. Mm-hmm. All of this makes me wonder, you know, do you think we need to reappraise what we mean when we say exploration?
I think so. But I also think it's a definition that has changed over time, and it has always changed. Mm-hmm. You know, with the advent of bigger and better ships, to, you know, land surveying equipment and navigation equipment. And now we're moving into an age where we're recording so much data that we are able to explore through that data. And I think recording is an interesting and important part to exploration.
By recording, you mean the data sets that you get from...
Right. Data sets and making a record. So for me, when I think about early explorers, what good is exploration if they don't record what they're doing? And in a way, we've expedited a lot of the recording process through satellites and GPS and automated weather systems, and all of this technology is enabling us to record so much that now we kind of need to explore the amount of data that we're collecting. And that's a large problem for us in the geospatial field is data storage in particular, and how do we analyze the massive amounts of data that we're receiving? And I think that's happening a lot in just regular science as well. But getting back to your question, as far as how we use the word exploration, I do think it's always been kind of an evolving thing, and to me, it's more going into the unknown and recording what we see and discovering new things. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a geographical space in which we do that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You know, at this moment that I'm talking about, you know, all of this remote exploration, I should point out that you have been in Antarctica many times at McMurdo. What were you doing there?
So we, each Antarctic field season, which runs between August and February or March, depending on how long you stay there, but we staff an office in McMurdo to provide on-site geospatial support to the science teams and logistics folks there, largely from the standpoint that the bandwidth doesn't allow us to send a lot of data down there. There's a large time difference between there and here. And from a safety standpoint, if something happens where there's an emergency situation, we're there on site to create maps, pull data together, and get teams out to assess the situation and hopefully make it more efficient in any rescue effort that needs to happen. So that's the main component of what we do in Antarctica. In the past, I believe it was 2011 and 12 and 2012, 2013, we were lucky enough to get a Google Trekker on loan from Google and approval from NSF to collect Google Street View in McMurdo, around McMurdo, and then in the McMurdo Dry Valleys as well, which was a really amazing experience.
Pretty much all of the Street Views for Google you've personally created,
yeah,
right?
Around McMurdo Station. If you go, I think there's some areas on the peninsula and Palmer Station side that are in Google Earth as well. But in the McMurdo Dry Valleys, yeah, that is all me walking, which was amazing, but a lot of work.
Yeah, they're awesome views. I'm going to make sure that we put up a link to your to your Street Views of Antarctica. They're really spectacular. I was wondering, you know, you've actually got both undergraduate and graduate degrees in surveying, survey mapping, and GIS.
Mm-hmm.
Was this the kind of work you thought you'd be doing when you were getting those degrees?
No. I mean, I've always felt very lucky in how things have worked out for me. I mean, when I was doing my land surveying degree, I was very focused on retracement surveying and going back and looking at how the original surveyors and second generation surveyors monumented and laid out the public land survey system that we use in the United States, and going back and trying to interpret what their intention was, because that's very important when you deal with boundaries and property rights. But as I progressed through that program, I took a GIS class, and that changed things for me, because I could just see that there were so many possibilities and applications that GIS can be used for. At the time, I was really interested in getting into GIS as a science, and now I still do that, but I think that GIS has become a larger tool than everyone thought it would be, because it can be applied to almost any type of research that has any sort of spatial component. We work with biologists, glaciologists, geologists, you name it. Even psychology is, you know, spatial psychology is a very interesting topic. So as I moved into my graduate degree, I didn't expect to be doing any sort of polar work, but I needed to fund my education somehow, so I applied for a research assistantship at the Polar Geospatial Center and was lucky enough to become a part of the group. And ever since then, I've fallen in love with the Arctic and Antarctic, because when I first got the job, I hadn't even thought about the Antarctic or Arctic hardly at all in my life. And having that awareness that most people don't think about it made me very interested in it and want to really work to improve the data that's there and maps and see what's going on in this region of the world that, you know, most people don't think about it even on a monthly basis.
Yeah. Well, Cole Kelleher, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah. Thanks, Michael.
That's it for today. The music for Time to Eat the Dogs was composed by Zabrat. If you'd like to recommend a guest or offer an opinion, please email me at timetoeatthedogs, that's one word, lowercase, @gmail.com. And please rate the show and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. It's really one of the best ways of reaching new listeners who might be interested in the show. See you next week.